from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Anodyne workers voted to unionize, but the parent company is challenging the vote. Today, we'll look at what happens next.
True victory will come when we get that first contract secured. But to say that we've made it this far is, I mean, I think we can go all the way. I mean, I know we will.
Then we'll learn about an oral history project coming to Milwaukee to gather the stories of survivors who attended Indian boarding schools.
Sometimes people do say that sharing their story has been healing for them. Sometimes people say it's been a weight lifted off of their shoulders, a weight that they've been carrying for 60 plus years.
Plus, we'll hear some new songs from local musicians in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Earlier this month, workers at Anodyne voted unanimously to unionize. But last week, its parent company, Fairwave, challenged the election results. A hearing is scheduled for later this month, which will determine whether the union vote will stand or another election must be held. Lake Effect's Sam Woods explores why Fairwave challenged the election results and what to expect next.
2 weeks ago, Sid Vineyard was feeling good. They are a coffee lead at Anodyne, a popular Milwaukee-based coffee chain, and they had spent several months organizing their workplace behind the scenes, eventually leading to 100% of Anodyne workers signing union authorization cards. An election date had been set where workers would officially vote yes for unionization or no to remain without a union. And when election day finally came and went, the votes were in.
It was unanimous. Not a single person voted no, which is unreal.
Anodyne workers voted 37-0 to form a union. This came 2 weeks after a health scare botched the initial election halfway through the process, which was rescheduled. The vote, seemingly, was decisive. But since the election, Fairwave, Anodyne's parent company and a Kansas City-based coffee conglomerate that owns coffee brands across the U.S., has challenged the results. According to documents from the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, the challenges allege that employees that could be considered supervisors unlawfully encouraged unionization and union representatives, quote, surveilled a Fairwave employee. Fairwave did not respond to a request for comment on these objections. But to understand what's happening, let's take a step back and examine three things. How common is it for every single employee at a company to favor unionization? What do Fairwave's objections to these election results mean? And what happens next? Let's find out. To the first question, the level of Anodyne workers' support for unionization is rare. In the lead-up to the election, every single Anodyne worker signed union authorization cards signaling their support for an NLRB election, and then every single employee voted for the union when that election day came. According to Dr. John Haywood, labor economist at UW-Milwaukee, this level of union support is rare.
100% in any election is unusual. It certainly reflects a unanimity of belief about the way the election should go. So when all the workers favor the union in an NLRB election, that's unusual. It does tend to happen more frequently, and not frequently, but more frequently when there's a small bargaining group that's seeking unionization. Nonetheless, I emphasize that 100% is not a common event.
Despite this, Fairwave is still challenging these results. Fairwave's objections to the election are twofold. The first is that employees they consider, quote, statutory supervisors, encouraged union activity and voted in the election. The complaint names five employees that allegedly did this, and Fairwave is asking for the election results to be thrown out based in part on these claims. But to understand what this means, we have to get into the weeds about what legally constitutes a supervisor. Matt Brunig, a lawyer who is representing Anodyne workers in the case, explains what supervisor means in labor law.
to be a supervisor, you have to have the authority to do one of 12 supervisory actions. Hire, transfer, suspend, lay off, recall, promote, discharge, assign, reward, or discipline, responsibly to direct employees or adjust their grievances. So you have to do one of those 12 things, and you have to do it while exercising independent judgment. So it can't just be that there's some other supervisor who kind of sets scheduling parameters and you happen to be the one who maybe fills out the schedule. That doesn't count because that's not exercising independent judgment.
However, the challenge names five employees who encouraged union activity and voted in the election were statutory supervisors. The word statutory is important here because it implies that the employees named have supervisory authority, whether their job title has supervisor in the name or not.
Job descriptions, job titles, and other similar documents actually are not relevant to determining whether someone is a supervisor. The NLRB's like case law on this says that those things are mere paper. So what they look at is not what does your job description say? What does your title say? What does any of that say? They look at, do you actually, in fact, possess this authority and actually, in fact, exercise this authority? Because obviously, if we start allowing people to establish supervisory status by putting special words in job descriptions, employers will start putting those words in all sorts of job descriptions where people are not supervisors.
At next week's hearing, Fairwave and the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Union, which Anodyne workers are attempting to unionize under, will argue over aspects of these alleged statutory supervisors' roles to determine whether they should be deemed legally supervisors and are unable to join the union, or not supervisors and remain eligible to join the union. One aspect that might be under consideration is the ability to train new employees, and whether that should be considered the ability to promote.
So when they're, you know, come on, there's like a training process, and after they're trained, they, you know, take on a certain role, like they get to work at the bar and that sort of thing. So they're trying to depict that training process as being the right to promote people. And we don't view that as promotion. That's for just training people, giving people, you know, advice and information about how to do their job. And the fact that management then says once training is complete, they get to do certain tasks, that doesn't mean she has promoted them. She's just, you know, like any coworker could help another coworker get better at a job and could even tell the supervisor, yeah, I've seen this person and they can do this job well. But that is not the same thing as them having the authority to promote someone or demote someone.
Fairwave's second objection revolves around alleged, quote, surveillance and, quote, intimidation of a Fairwave employee by union representatives. There is little information in the complaint about what this refers to, and Fairwave did not explain this claim further. I asked Brunig what he's heard about this.
The word intimidate and the word surveil, you know, catches the eye. And so I want to make sure to ask you directly, are you able to give a response at this time to that second claim alleging intimidation and surveillance of a Fairwave employee?
I'm being fully straightforward with you when I say I have yet to figure out what they're talking about. There was an incident that was relayed to me that someone was like, I think this is what they're talking about, but I actually don't think that that's true. And because the incident they were talking about involved like a higher up in Fairwave, and a higher up in Fairwave would not matter, right? Because they're not in the bargaining unit anyways. So I don't actually know what that refers to. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. You know, we haven't had the hearing yet, but yeah, I don't know what that would refer to. And like I said, you know, the standard here is, you know, is this going to, would this overturn an election? And that allegation by itself is of one employee. You know, they won 37-0. So I would like to get to the bottom of it to just see if that happened at all and like figure out what's going on there. But it also doesn't seem like it would have a huge impact on the outcome of this challenge.
Which brings us to the third part of this. What happens next? On paper, Fairwave is asking for the NLRB to throw out these election results and hold a new election. If after the hearing the NLRB decides they are right, we may have another election. But Dr. Haywood, the labor economist at UW-Milwaukee, says it is common for employers to file objections to NLRB elections that go against their wishes, though not as common when votes are unanimous. The strategy is usually to delay the actual implementation of the union and extend the period between the election and the first collectively bargained contract.
Often the purpose of the objections is to slow down the process of eventually reaching a contract and eventually perhaps hoping that this composition of the workforce will change and that new elections may not favor the union or that, as mentioned, that first contract won't be reached in a timely fashion. But again, this is more common when you have a close election, not when you have a unanimous election.
Brunig says he's seen the strategy of continuous delay before, including at other coffee chains nationwide.
If you can make this thing go for years and years and years, you can get a total turnover of the staff. People will begin to believe that unionization is futile. And then formally, you can even sometimes get a decertification of the union, right? So, you know, if you can get 30% of the workers who now don't want the union, which if you've had a long time to replace workers and some people are demoralized, maybe you can, then you can essentially run an election to get the union voted out. And so you see that with a lot of employers, you know, oppose the election results, refuse to bargain, refuse to reach an agreement, and then attempt to decertify the union. This has happened actually with many Starbucks locations. Now, I don't think they've won any decertifications, but they've run that playbook. You know, Starbucks has not reached any collective agreements with any of its units, any of its stores. And there have been a number of decertification petitions submitted. So it's a standard playbook, if you will.
Workers at Colectivo, another popular coffee brand in Milwaukee, went through similar delays after their unionization election in 2021. Its election was much closer, with just over half of its employees voting to unionize. Sid Vineyard, coffee lead at Anodyne and one of the organizers of this unionization attempt, said Colectivo's experience has been top of mind since the beginning.
Very early on when we had some of our initial meetings when we first started forming this union and it was just very few members, I think there was some initial trepidation because a lot of people were familiar with how it went for Colectivo, and unfortunately, like, those workers were put through a lot and really demoralized, and they did not deserve that. And we looked at what happened to them as, like, strategizing as to ways to be like, let's work smarter so this doesn't happen to us. Like, so we made more calculated moves. Like, it's the reason why when we demanded recognition, they had no idea. They didn't find out. They simply didn't know. So every move we've made has been in the shadow of just looking at that and just figuring out ways to just plan so that doesn't happen.
John Jacobs is the business manager at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, or IBEW, under which Colectivo workers are unionized. It took over 2 years between the union election and striking the first contract, in part because of the challenges Colectivo filed to the election results.
After the vote, Colectivo did challenge. They submitted their challenge, which they have every right to do so. Ultimately, the union prevailed. And now the next step was to begin negotiations for the first contract.
And that's not a simple task. As Jacobs explains, the second, third, and fourth contract is usually easier to negotiate because both sides have a previous agreement to build from. With the first contract, everything is up in the air.
When you think about it, first contract is just that. You have to come up with and develop the language for the first contract. Sometimes what you get caught up on is in that moment when negotiating the first contract is trying to solve every issue through language, and you just can't do that. We're a local that's 119 years old this year. We're still refining our contracts, right, over time. And it was no different with Colectivo. And the most important thing that we had realized was just getting that first contract.
However, in the 2 years since the first contract was finalized, Colectivo and the IBEW have already agreed to a second contract and kept a business relationship alive that has benefited both employees and their employer.
And just a small example of that is just last week, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers hosted their Broadcasting, Manufacturing, and Telecommunications Conference right here in Milwaukee. And our international bought each attendee a 1-pound bag of coffee to be put in their gift bag, and that is an amount of 350 attendees. And then our local union agreed to purchase 5 5-pound bags of coffee to be given away as raffle prizes. So not only is it a great working relationship by keeping those lines of communication open, but understanding the effects of working together, in this case, purchasing the actual product we produce.
Anodyne workers and Fairwave seem far away from this kind of amicable relationship. After next week's hearing, one of two things will happen. One path is that Fairwave's challenges are upheld and the election results are thrown out. In this case, we likely see another union election. The other path is that the election results are upheld and the union is recognized. But even that second option may not lead directly to the bargaining table. According to Brunig, Fairwave can take its challenges all the way up to the National NLRB, which, after recent firings from the Trump administration, is currently not able to have quorum and hear cases at all.
What they can do from there is they lose the election challenge. They can refuse to bargain with the union, and then the union would have to file a charge with the NLRB alleging that they're refusing to bargain. And then as part of that, they would defend their refusal to bargain by saying that actually their election challenges were valid and that the regional director made a mistake in not rerunning the election. And so then we have even more delay. And since the board has no quorum at the moment, that case would fully stall out in the process. So, you know, it's just kind of a union busting tactic in a lot of cases, not like a genuine effort to get it overturned. It's just kind of abusing the process to prevent people from prevent them from having to bargain with the union and reach an agreement.
Workers like Vineyard were never under the illusion that the union election was the end all be all. And the point was always that first contract bargained on equal footing with Fairwave. But with these unanimous election results and the support for unionization they represent, confidence in reaching a collectively bargained contract is still high.
True victory will come when we get that first contract secured. But to say that we've made it this far is, I mean, I think we can go all the way. I mean, I know we will.
That piece was produced by Lake Effect Sam Woods. You can read more about this story at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll bring you some new local music in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. But first, an oral history project is coming to Milwaukee to gather the stories of survivors of Indian boarding schools.
The Federal Indian Boarding School legacy and era has affected all of us, whether directly or indirectly. And so we can all relate to that with each other, to be able to share space with one another and talk about it and talk with each other and share with each other. Again, profound healing can come from that.
We'll learn about the project and what it hopes to achieve. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. All next week, an organization will be in the Milwaukee area collecting personal oral histories. The stories being gathered are from Indigenous elders who attended one of Wisconsin's Indian boarding schools. The goal is to understand and address the ongoing trauma created by U.S. Indian boarding school policies. WUWM's Eric Vaughn fellow Maria Peralta Arellano and Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with Charlie Brissett. She's the Oral History Program Manager for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. She talks about the impacts the school had both in Wisconsin and throughout the country.
The beginning of the boarding school era started in and before the 1880s, but it was around that time where Richard Henry Pratt, who is credited with starting Carlisle Industrial School in Pennsylvania, it wasn't the earliest school, but it was one of the earliest schools that was used as a model to design the rest of the Native American boarding schools that were federally supported in the United States. And our organization has now found and researched that there have been over 526 schools identified now in what is known as the United States. You know, as we know, colonization has played a huge role into the determinants of health of our communities and Native American individuals. So every person has been impacted by the effects of not only colonization, but the Indian boarding school legacy.
You got into a little bit about what the boarding schools did, right? Like all of the ways that it was a forced assimilation and just how prolific the system was dating back to the 1880s. So pretty recently here in Wisconsin, and that there are over 500 of these schools nationwide. I'm curious about the why. Can we spend some more time with exactly what was the purpose behind these schools? Why were they built?
So it's going to depend kind of on which sources you're taking information from. But there were multiple reasons for these schools. And the biggest thing is to erase an entire race of people and to eradicate a culture and an entire group of people. Sometimes we say it was our American Indian genocide. It was also part of the land grab, you know, by weakening communities, by separating families, separating and destroying family units. It made communities easier to target for land grab initiatives. It's so multifaceted. It's really unimaginable, the breadth of the effects of not just boarding schools, but boarding schools were part of a larger system, right, to erase and eradicate a people.
Anything that has to do with colonization is a painful history to tell, and it can take a lot of strength and courage to tell those stories and tell those experiences with it. So with the project and the nature of how violent that these schools were, why is it important to record and preserve those stories from the survivors themselves?
That is a wonderful question. The first thing that I will say is because this is the true history, this is the truth coming directly from those that attended these institutions. And so we know it is the truth because it's exactly what has happened to them. And so we need to preserve these histories so that they don't get lost and that they're not forgotten and that they're recorded and preserved for not only their family's legacy and their own legacy, but for generations to come. There can be profound healing that comes from sharing one story. And we see that on a regular basis with our oral history project.
Walk me through what a day looks like as far as someone who is coming in to share this experience with you.
Sure. When they come in, when they arrive, we have a welcome room set up. We try to make it a very warm and inviting room. There's windows to see nature. We have different staff members there who are available to sit and visit and share coffee and share refreshments and things like that. Part of the intake process is an informed consent. And then they go from that into portrait photography where they will have a professional portrait taken. And these portraits are absolutely stunning. And the survivor and relative will get a copy of their portraits, and they'll also get a copy of their interview as well, which is super important to know. From the portrait photography, they go into the interview space. And in the interview room, it is closed to the public. So it's just the interviewer, the videographer, and the oral historian, unless the survivor brings a support person, which they're allowed to do. There's a list of questions that we are comfortable sending ahead of time so people can review them and get comfortable with them. But sometimes we don't make it through all the questions. Sometimes people skip some questions, and that's totally okay. The most important thing I always say is the story that you want to share, the story that wants to be told. You know, that's the most important thing. And so our interviews last anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour and a half. It just depends on what you want to share. From there, we go into a quiet room with our Indigenous licensed professional counselor who specializes in boarding school history and trauma-informed care. And yeah, then that's it. And so people come and they just come for their interview portion and then that's it and they leave. Or some people, you know, end up staying with us the whole week. So we really try to do what we can to eliminate any obstacles or any barriers for participating. And so if there's any questions, you know, people can please feel free to reach out to me directly and I'd be happy to answer and see how we can make it work.
Thanks for breaking that down for us, Charlie. And it sounds like there's so many different ways that people could express themselves and find an outlet after they share their stories. And as we all know, healing comes in different ways for different people. And for the people who are coming to share their stories, what does closure or healing look like for survivors specifically?
That is a great question, Maria. It's also hard for me to say exactly because that is a question that we ask every survivor that comes and sits down with us. But what does healing look like or feel like to you? And so sometimes people do say that sharing their story has been healing for them. Sometimes people say it's been a weight lifted off of their shoulders, a weight that they've been carrying for 60 plus years. Sometimes it's the first time they're sharing some of these stories. And it can have profound healing impacts. We've had family members. For example, we had a mother and a daughter come in once, and they both attended boarding schools, and they both interviewed with us. And then they shared with us later on in the week that it was really able to open some doors for communication for them. We've even had somebody to share with us one of our best compliments we've ever received. Somebody shared with us that sitting down with us and sharing their story and spending time with us was better than the years of therapy work that they've been doing. As Native people, as Indigenous people, we can relate to one another because we've all been through this. We're all part of this. Like I said earlier, the Federal Indian Boarding School legacy and era has affected all of us, whether directly or indirectly. And so we can all relate to that with each other. To be able to share space with one another and talk about it and talk with each other and share with each other. Again, profound healing can come from that.
I find it interesting that you're doing this work because if it sounds like you have a personal attachment to this work within your own family, it feels like you have a specific lens on seeing the value of elders talking about this history.
Yeah, I have a direct connection to this work. My mom is a boarding school survivor of Holy Childhood of Jesus in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Her brothers went there. Some of her cousins went there. I didn't find out that my mom went to boarding school until I was in college and I was learning about boarding schools for the first time. And when I found out that she had gone to a boarding school, my jaw hit the floor and I was stunned. And so we talked about it. And to be concise, I'll just share that the conversations that we had at that time versus the conversations that we have now are so different. You know, they're so evolved. When we started out talking about them, you know, initially she was defensive because she, and in a way, she had a positive experience there at boarding school. She had a roof over her head. She had 3 square meals. She had a bed. There wasn't abuse, whereas there was alcoholism and there was poverty and there was, you know, abuses at home happening because, again, colonization has had that intergenerational effect, right? Now, she's, like I said, our conversations have evolved. So she's been able to see that there were different things that she maybe didn't realize were happening at the school. But looking back now, she sees, wow, that's wrong, or wow, that's not okay. I remember one time we were having a conversation, and this was just a couple years ago, and she told me that they washed her hair in kerosene when she first got there. I looked at her and I said, Mom, that's not normal. You know, that's not okay. And she's like, you know what? You're right. That's not normal. And we see that, you know, with our oral history project and the stories that we hear, we see different stories from all different angles and all different perspectives. You know, we want to hear everybody's story. We want to hear the good and the bad and everything in between, because again, everybody's story deserves to be heard. But it's definitely had a direct impact on my family. And then doing this project, working on this oral history project, has had a profound healing impact on not only myself, but my family as well. It's impacted our family in a positive way.
And for someone who's been doing this work for so long and so passionately, what would you want people to know about the survivors who are sharing their stories? And I'm also interested in what you would want people to know about the survivors who chose not to.
The first thing that comes to mind for me is there's a strong sense of courage and strength that it takes to share one story, because this process can get into some very, very vulnerable spaces. What I will say for those that have interviewed with us is just that they are exactly that. They are survivors and they are strong. They are incredible individuals, incredible human beings. And each one has a story, you know, and even those relatives that haven't been called to share, maybe it's just not their time yet, and that's okay. And we honor that. Everybody's at a different place in their journey. You know, this is just an opportunity. And if it comes at the right time, then it's coming at the right time. Maybe this is a sign that it's time to share your story, you know, by hearing this. And so we don't pressure anybody if they're, you know, not ready to share. That's okay. But we are ready to hear and to hold space if and when somebody's ready to share their story.
That was Charlie Brissett, Oral History Program Manager for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. She spoke with WUWM's Maria Peralta Arellano and Jimmy Gutierrez. If you or someone you know has history that you'd like to share, you can find more information about how to sign up at WUWM.com. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll hear some new local music, including a new single out from Trapper Shep. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As the city prepares for thousands of visitors for Summerfest, there are also many local bands preparing to perform for the throngs of festival goers. And Matt Wild is ready for all of it. Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record and a big fan of local music. Every month, he creates a list of some of the best new songs from local musicians. He joins me now to share a few of those songs. Matt, thank you as always for being here on Lake Effect.
Wonderful to be here, and thanks for having me back.
So the first song comes from someone our listeners will be very familiar with, a former Lake Effect intern. He wrote our theme music. He also now co-hosts a series we have here called Live at Lake Effect. This is, of course, Trapper Shep.
Trapper Shep. You know him. You love him. The talented, the tall, the handsome, the wonderful Trapper Shep.
Ooh.
Yes. Trapper, of course, has been a mainstay of Milwaukee music for many, many years now. And he's got a new record coming out this fall. The name of the record is called Osborne. And it's a bit of a dark album, but also not a dark album. It's an album that's dealing with Trapper's newfound sobriety. As he has said in press materials in 2024, he visited a addiction treatment center to get sober. And now, about a year later, here he is. He is sober. And this new record is kind of celebrating that fact. Of course, it's a like I said, kind of a dark subject. But he has made a point of saying it doesn't have to be all dark. It doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. This can be kind of a celebration. And so he just released a single from this record, and the single is called Loaded. And it is about kind of being over-medicated. It's a kind of this idea of having a kind of constant refills of pills kind of as a loaded gun. That's kind of the metaphor going on in here. There's also a video that Trapper has released for this song. It features Milwaukee legend Mark Borchert in it as well. And it is a very fun video and backs up that kind of, you know, that this doesn't have to be a dark, gloomy subject. I also really, really love the song itself. It's a great new sound for Trapper. I'm really, really looking forward to this album. Comes out in September. Until then, we can enjoy the first single from Osborne, and it is called Loaded.
Trapper Shep. Moving to our next song, this is from another Milwaukee music scene staple, a very different genre. I would say this is a kind of dancey electropop sound.
Absolutely. This is someone I know we've talked about many times on the show before because she always puts out a ton of work, and it's always great. It is Luxie. She is an electro artist here in Milwaukee, and she just kind of does it all. Anytime that I'm feeling like overwhelmed or like, oh boy, I really need a break, I look to someone like Luxie, and it's like, what has she been doing in the last 2 weeks? Oh, she's released 6 videos. She made her own video game. She opened a store. She closed a store. She does all these things. She is very, very busy, and she also puts out great music. So she has a new single. It is called Heartbeats. And it's a great kind of neon-drenched summer song. It's good for just driving around at night and just with your windows down. That's going to come up later, too. A lot of summer songs on this installment. And, yeah, I think it's great. Like I said, Luxie, always busy, always fantastic. And here she is with her latest single. It is called Heartbeats.
Luxie. Switching genres once again, this next song, it has a very folksy sound with a kind of folksy subject matter. The name of the band is pretty intriguing, Bicentennial
drug lord.
That's right. Yes. Bicentennial drug lord. Really interesting backstory with Bicentennial drug lord, or BDL, if you prefer. They kind of a super group of sorts, kind of some Milwaukee music veterans that way back in 1997, sometime in the late 90s, they were all in kind of their mainline bands, and they got together and they formed this little side band, Bicentennial Drug Lord. And it was kind of a chance for them to play these kind of alt-country, kind of folksy, like you said, kind of songs that weren't the normal kind of offerings from their mainline bands. That was way back in the 90s. Fast forward to 2021, they kind of came back. They got back together as Bicentennial Drug Lord and released a really fantastic self-titled EP a few years ago. And now in 2025, they're prepping the release of a full-length album. It is called You Are Never Alone. That is the name of the record. And the name of the song, kind of the first track off that album, is called This Pabst Blue Ribbon. And it is it's a real sitting at a bar, drinking a PBR, and just kind of feeling bad about yourself and looking back on your life and the mistakes. And it's one of those kind of classic songs. I really, really like it. And this whole album, I've heard most of it. It's not all this gloomy. It's a really terrific record. And though I do love this song as well. So this is Bicentennial Drug Lord with This Pabst Blue Ribbon.
This Pabst Blue Ribbon is so forgiving. It never asks me why you don't want me. This Pabst Blue Ribbon is so forgiving. It never asks me if you still want me. But haunt me you do, like a spirit in this bar used to tell me I love you. You stole my hand. Now all this sand is sold in is this ice cold can of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
This Pabst Blue Ribbon by Bicentennial Drug Lord. So the final song we're looking at is from a group that seems relatively new here in Milwaukee, and they have a bit of an indie rock vibe.
Absolutely. This is the latest song and record from the Hallelujah Ward. Now, I could have sworn I had talked about this song in particular, what we're going to hear before. I had a look back in the archives. I'm like, how did I not talk about this song? Because the song we're going to be listening to from the Hallelujah Award, it's called Manageable Oblivion. It was actually released last year on an EP. Now the group is back with a full LP. It is called Everybody Swoons. And this song is just, I just love, 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 love this song. One of my favorite songs in a long time. The Hallelujah Award is fronted by the great Mark Waldock. If you have any familiarity with the Milwaukee music scene, if you've been around for a while, you know Mark. If you've been in any bar, he's probably served you a drink. He is a fantastic person, a fantastic singer, as you can hear on this record. And he's been around and doing music for forever. And he is just a Milwaukee treasure. And yes, his new group, the Hallelujah Ward, they do have this record out. Like I said, it's called Everybody Swoons. And this song, Manageable Oblivion, it's the second track on the album. It's the single. I love this song. It was just a few days ago. I was driving over the Hone Bridge. It was a beautiful afternoon. I had the windows down, and this song came on the radio. I cranked it up, and I don't know if I've ever felt that good in years, just blasting this song, driving over the bridge on a beautiful early summer day. It's fantastic. So if you out there are now driving around, I implore you to crank the volume and listen to the Hallelujah Ward with Manageable Oblivion.
I'm
Manageable Oblivion by the Hallelujah Ward. Now, we are full into, it feels like, the summer swing. We have already had some great festivals happening. What are you looking forward to?
You're right. We are in the thick of it. We've already done the Locust Street Festival. We've done Festa, Pride, and now coming up, we've got Summer Solstice and, of course, Summerfest. There is just a ton of stuff. If I could do a shameless plug here, if you look on MilwaukeeRecord.com and you find our summer festival list, which includes summer festivals and free music series, we have at least one, two, three, or sometimes four things every day that are going on in the city of Milwaukee from now through September. Every day there's live music. It is impossible not to stumble upon live music from now until the end of the summer. So I'm kind of ready. Usually I'm kind of already overwhelmed at this point, but I'm staying positive. I'm taking a deep breath, and here I am, and here I'm ready to go. So yeah, check that out. Check out some live music this summer. It's like I said, it's impossible not to. I'm ready. I hope you are ready too.
A lot to look forward to and listen to this summer. Matt Wild, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he joins Lake Effect to talk about some of the best new music from local bands. At WUWM.com, you can find all of our previous conversations. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn all about Wisconsin's state bird, the robin. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.